Okay. All right. Today is December the 17th, 2003, and I'm at Mike Fleming's home in Sharpsburg, Georgia, and we have a special guest with us here today, who is Mr. Donnie Lee. And Donnie has been working in bluegrass in the North Georgia community for many years, and so we're going to start off with a little bit of a history there and whatever Donnie feels he would like for us to know about. So, Donnie, I guess my first question would be to just, if you could give us a little bit of a history of Bullsboro and when it started, how it got started, and then Mike can kind of take over from there, and we'll move in that direction.
Thank you, Bill. I guess I have kind of a family background in music. My mother and two of her sisters were part of the founding members of a group called the Kansas Ladies Quartet. And they played during the 30s and traveled some as far as Birmingham. And back then, that was a pretty good ways. And my mother's only brother, his name was Berlin Bearden, and he was a clawhammer banjo player. And I really liked the sound of the banjo very early on. And I believe it was 1947. My dad was stationed in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and he took us to see Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys in Elizabethton, Kentucky. And if I'm not mistaken, that was the bluegrass band with Chubby Wise and Cedric Rainwater, Flat Scruggs, and Monroe. Yeah, I didn't really know what they were doing, but I knew I liked what I heard. Always had a fondness for that style of music, and in 1971, I formed a band called L&P Express with Joe Partridge, later a founding member of Bullsboro. And I had seen Jay and Anoni Baxter, the Bluegrass Five, perform, and they just inspired me to think that one day I might could have a bluegrass band as well. And Joe and I played together as L&P Express from 71 to 73, and then together we kind of came up with the name of Bullsboro. It was originally Bullsboro Bluegrass Band, but a lot of people had a hard time running all those B's together, so it was eventually shortened to Bullsboro. Named after the town of Noonan, which was known as Bullsboro during the Civil War. And started playing in 73, and this is started playing as Bullsboro in 73, and 30 years later, we're still trying.
How'd you start playing? I mean, you talked about you heard the music, and then you started a band, but somewhere in there, you had to get an instrument and learn to play yourself.
Well, my mother was a great piano player and an outstanding singer, great harmony singer, one of a great alto singer. And my brother and I, my older brother Barry, he and I started playing the piano at her insistence when we were young. And we had 4 years of classical piano. We had 3 years of classical piano while my dad was stationed in Trieste, Italy. And when we moved back to the States, carrying around a piano was a lot harder than carrying around a banjo, and I kind of fell again under the influence of my uncle and decided that I wanted to be a banjo player. Started working on it, and 71, when Joe and I started L&P Express, he wouldn't play the bass, so I showed him what very little I knew on the five-string banjo, and he took it and went from there, and I wound up as a bass player, and been stuck there on the bass, which I enjoy playing, but in my heart, I always wanted to be that banjo player. I think that, if I remember correctly, we may have had the second bluegrass festival in Georgia that I can recall. I know that the Cobb County Bluegrass Festival, Mr. Dillard Rogers, had his festival going, and it was a great festival. We wanted to have one. And Joe and I started the Bullsboro Bluegrass Festival in May of 1973, and we hosted it at the Cuyahoga County Fairgrounds until 79, I believe. And then we went to Peachtree City and played and hosted the festival at the McIntosh Opry for a couple of years. And then wound up, I believe, in 82 and 83 in Carrollton at the fairgrounds there. And after 10 years, we had decided we'd lost about as much money as we could afford to lose for bluegrass music. Loved it, loved all the great people that we met, and just had a great time. Mike and I met each other, I believe, in 1972, when he came to work with the same agency that I was working with. And a couple of years later, we found ourselves working, both of us working at the central office in Atlanta, and we started committing together not too long after that. Mike, help me out.
Would have probably been late 77, early 1978.
Okay.
77, probably.
And Mike and I started talking about bluegrass music, and he's a lot better singer, was able to sing harmony as well as lead, and so we started singing all the way to work and back, and probably not too many years after that, he hooked up with our original banjo player, Joe Partridge, and they formed a band, Brushfire, that has been going for 26 years.
26 years. You on the way home from work, Joe had left Bullsboro again. If I could just interject this, Joe had left Bullsboro, I guess, for the second or third time after having come back playing simulated dobro for a while. He left again. He and Eddie started a group, and I remember you telling me if I wanted to play, if I was interested in playing, I ought to call them because they need the guitar player. And they've been through most every other guitar player in town.
Boy, that's a lot of great memories. A lot of great memories.
who were the original members of Bullsboro?
Joe Partridge and myself, Joe's cousin Tommy McCoon, and later we met a gentleman named Junior Bundy. I was coaching Little League football here in Noonan in 1970, 71, and 72, and Junior Bundy's son was on my football team, and one day he said he hated to leave practice early, but that he was there to watch his son practice. He said, "I got to play in Atlanta." And I said, "What do you play?" And he said, "Well, I play guitar, fiddle, mandolin." And I said, "Well, come to practice tomorrow, we'll talk." And so he was a serious musician. He was a country musician, but he was from Indiana, and he knew all about bluegrass. He was a great fiddle player, great mandolin player, and he played with us for about a year.
Okay, so this original configuration then worked together for what, about 2 to 3 years?
From 71 till October of 73, and we were at the Cobb County Festival in Marietta. And the four of us were on our way to the stage, and we walked by, and Mike Steed was sitting in the trunk of his Buick, and Johnny Jackson was standing up playing mandolin, and we went and did our stage show, came back, and those two guys were still jamming, and I stopped and listened to them for a little bit, and we played a little bit, and I thought, we need some help, and I believe those guys can help us. So the next day, which would have been Saturday, I guess, we asked them if they would play on stage with us. And Johnny had been playing bass previously, I believe, for Murray Freeman and the Ridge Runners. So he had stage experience, but Mike didn't. But they played with us on that Saturday night show at Marietta. And I believe Mike Steed's, the closest he got to the microphone was about 10 feet. But all that's changed now. He's right up there with it. And so they joined us, and Joe, Johnny, Mike, and myself. And who am I leaving out?
Butch.
No, Butch replaced Joe on the banjo in 1970s.
Tommy was already gone.
Yeah. I guess there were just the four of us then. Whenever Joe left, I guess Tommy left, and that's when Mike and Johnny joined us, and that would have been 73. But Butch joined us in 79, I believe. No, let me think.
Before that,
yeah.
He was playing banjo when Joe came back on Simulated Dobro.
Yeah. That would have been...
When did you do the album?
78.
Butch was already established.
Yeah, I guess 75 or 6 he joined us, yeah. Boy, time diminishes my memory. I hate to admit that, but it does.
Well, you know, Mike just brought up something here. I have really enjoyed listening to this CD that you have re-released. Was it 1978?
1978, recorded live in Carrollton, Georgia.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that recording, how it came about, and I understand you were a little under the weather at that time as well.
Well, we had been talking about wanting to do an album, and none of us, well, to be honest, we really knew very little about music. We were just having a good time. And somebody said something about, why don't y'all make a record? And we thought the easiest way for us to do it would be to just do it live. And so the gentleman from Adoram Records,
Carl Queen,
and John Farley came down, set the equipment up, and we played three sets that night, and hoping we would get enough material off that show to do the album. And fortunately, we did. If anybody put any thought into it, it would have been Mike Steed, because the rest of us were just, you know, excited to be playing. And you mentioned a little bit about being on the weather. I had a little bit of tendonitis, and Mike Fleming was kind enough to take care of me there for a day or two. And I was taking some prescription pain medication, and that night was a little bit of a blur for me. I could tell by the speed of my speech on the stage, but we had a great time. We had a great time.
Well, I have really enjoyed listening to that, and one of the things I'd like to ask you about, as far as the material that you were doing back in those days, I've noticed that you had a lot of different influences, and not just a standard Bill Monroe, Ralph Stanley, Flatten Scruggs influences. Could you tell us maybe a little bit about some of the influences that you were dealing with as you picked the music that you were doing on stage?
We loved the Stanley Brothers, we loved Monroe, we loved Flatten Scruggs, all of the traditional founders of this music, but we couldn't sound like them. Try as hard as we wanted to, we just could not. And so we chose to try to do music with bluegrass instrumentation, but we didn't want to try to sound like somebody else, because we weren't good enough to do that. So we just selected material that we thought we could have fun with and relate it, you know, to bluegrass music as closely as we could, and just have fun doing it. And that was all that band did, was just have a great time. We played somewhere almost every weekend. And we really, we just enjoyed what we were doing. Influences came from all of the different styles of music that we liked, but if I could have sang like any of the people that I idolized, I would have, but I didn't have the talent to do it. So we just made music the best we could.
I remember from that period, and what I think about when I think about that album, well, any one particular cut was Frisco, because I know you were really into A.L. Woods and Dewey Farmer and those guys at that point. I remember.
Yeah. A.L. Wood was probably the first lead banjo player, lead singing banjo player that I could recall, and I was just overwhelmed with how Dewey Farmer, you know, could ride that mandolin. Like most bands utilize a five-string banjo, they utilize that, Dewey's mandolin, and boy, they had a tremendous amount of energy, and I liked what they were doing.
Where did the Joys of Quebec come from? That was another one on there.
You know, Mike, Steve and I have had this conversation before, and we think Johnny Jackson had either met or heard a fellow from Canada, Jacques St. Pierre, if I'm not mistaken. Now, whether he wrote the song or passed it on to Johnny, but I believe Johnny heard that, brought it to the band, and he and Mike worked up the arrangement for it, and that's how we came about putting that in the show, without a fiddle, but it was a fiddle tune.
Okay, we have looked at several members who have been through the group and this kind of thing, but of course there's been a couple of constants, yourself and is it Mike?
Mike Steed.
Okay.
Mike and I have been playing 30 years. Mike took a little time away to take care of his business in the early years. 81, I think, was when Mike left the band, and then later, due to his dad's poor health, he left the band temporarily again. But we've been playing bluegrass music together off and on, and mostly on, for 30 years. And had some really, really good musicians come through the band, and I guess their talents were so much greater than ours, they went on to better things. But trying to think of some of the banjo players, the first one being Joe Partridge, and then Butch Adams, and then Don Dysart, who probably had the strongest right hand of any banjo player. Dale Tilley, Ricky Rakestraw has helped us out on several occasions. Joey Coffey, Barry Waldrop,
Al Smith,
Jeff Barr, great traditional banjo player. He's got all those licks. Wally Offord played banjo with his son. Mike, who am I overlooking?
Jeff Partridge is the only other one that.
Certainly not overlooking Jeff because he's playing with us now.
Nobody else
pops up in our
brains to mind at the moment.
Like I said, I wanted to play banjo, but talent kept me from it, and the fact that nobody else would play the bass.
Mandolin players.
Johnny Jackson, the first one with the Bullsboro Band in 1973. Tony Duck, probably one of the most creative mandolin players, played with us for about 12 or 13 years, and he played either lead guitar or mandolin, played mandolin after Johnny left. Barry Waldrop also played mandolin. Jeff Partridge has actually played mandolin with us. Bless his heart, he can play anything, so we just wear him out. Who else am I overlooking?
There must have been another mandolin player somewhere out there.
Recently, in Four Winds West, who was it?
Todd
Freeman. Thank you. Man, I should have done a little more prep work before I got here. Todd is a great singer, and he played mandolin and played guitar for us. Tony Duck, Todd, Al Smith, and myself played together for a couple of years. And then Todd, Jeff Barr, Mike, Zach, and I played together for a couple of years, two or three years.
Okay, we're kind of up to the early 80s, and of course we're covering a lot of this all at the same time and so on, but in the early 80s now, what was happening with Bullsboro at that point? Early to mid-80s.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, Mike left in 81, Johnny Jackson left, and Butch wasn't sure how much more he wanted to play at that particular time, so it took me a while to put another band together, but Al Smith played some during that time, Johnny Slayton, Jeff Partridge, Tony Duck, and the four of us, Tony, Johnny, Jeff, and myself, probably played together for 5 or 6 years. Mike Steed came back and helped us some during that period of time. Then Ricky Rakestraw helped some during that time. There were a fair amount of band turnover during that period. Then in the 90s, it began to stabilize again. And for the last several years now, my son-in-law and Mike's youngest son, David Steed, Zach Steed, Mike, myself, and Jeff Partridge, or Jeff Barr, have been pretty much the basis for the band for the last 7 or 8 years, 9 years maybe.
Okay, I've got a couple more things that I wanted to kind of pursue just a little bit here, and one of those is, before we get to the latest release, the latest CD there, you've been associated with Hoopers for 3 or 4 years, I believe, also, and you want to tell us a little bit maybe about how that association came about, some of the things that you do in that regard.
Well, it came about kind of the same way my induction into the Georgia Country Music Hall of Honor for bluegrass music, and that's through my friend Mike Fleming, who actually was the catalyst for Hoopers now being a bluegrass venue. So I'll let Mike answer that, if you would, please.
Well, actually, you and I got, I think we were both down there for the same festival, and both had the same idea. I talked to Rick and encouraged him one night, and then the next day I think you and I talked and you said, I think we ought to try to help this guy out and get involved. And I said, yeah, I do too. I already talked to him. So then you called him and we both got involved at that point, just trying to encourage Rick to go ahead and do what he wanted, what we knew he wanted to do, and he had the wherewithal to do, but he just wasn't quite ready to make the jump, I don't think. So we both jumped in and encouraged him and offered our advice and expertise, and kind of feel like we kind of got him started. Donnie has hung with him, whereas I chose to bail out for other commitments after a couple of years.
Mike and I did MC the first few shows down there together. And Mike still comes back and helps us when he can and when we need him, and we need him pretty regular. But Hoopers has grown. Initially, I think maybe there were 2 festivals a year.
I think he started at two.
And next year in 2004, we're going to host 5 festivals down there in February, April, June, August, and October. Rick Torrance has really put the money into the programs down there, and we're developing a larger audience as we go. Particularly right now, the festival in February, Larry Stevenson, and the festival in August, Gary Waldrop, those are pretty much sellouts, and we're still working on the other 3 to try to bolster them. The April festival this year will be the first one that we've had in April.
And I noticed you also manning one of the booths at IBMA, also representing Hoopers.
I did, and I wish I could take credit for that, but I believe that actually Jeff Partridge is the one that said, you know, why don't we see if we can put together a plan to go to IBMA and promote Hoopers there. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down and came up with a plan, presented it to Rick, and he bought into it. And so we had the opportunity to go up there and stay for a week and work as every hour, every minute that they would allow us to have the booth open. We were there, and Mike Fleming again bailed us out. He came by and relieved us some so we could get up and walk around a little bit, see what else was up there. And we have plans to go up to the Spigma Festival in Nashville in February of 2004 to promote Hoopers there.
Okay. A couple of more points, and obviously we want to talk a little bit about the Hall of Honor. We want to talk about the latest CD. Oh, excuse me. But one of the things, being a bass player myself, I'd like to hear a little bit about the instruments. I know you played upright, and you also have an electric. So would you mind kind of sharing a little bit of information about that?
I started with the acoustic bass, upright bass, in 71, only because nobody else would play it, and I didn't know anything about playing a bass. Kind of watched other bass players and tried to, I guess, replicate what they were doing. And then just started banging around on it. It started to make a little bit of sense to me, and I'd much rather play an acoustic bass. But when we started, sound men were not nearly as good as they are now, nor was sound equipment. Technology has advanced that a lot. But if I had my druthers, I would be an upright bass player. But there were so many festivals we played at where the sound just wasn't right. It was muddled. You couldn't hear it on stage. So for that reason, I guess in the mid-80s, we went to electric bass. And while I don't enjoy playing it as much as I do the upright, with a little amp, you can kind of at least make it to where everybody on the stage could hear it back then, right. Yeah. And it really helped with timing. Electric basses are easier to play. I'm fortunate to have a mid-70s Fender Jazz. And again, I think Mike Fleming was with me when we bought that at Lee Music Store from Bob Donaldson in Atlanta. We've spent a lot of time together in the last 30 years, right?
Yeah.
But I'd rather play an acoustic bass. And
do you still have your acoustic?
Have two.
Oh, okay.
I have a M1K, I believe, that was made in 1950, and an M16K that came from Mike Steeb. He bought that bass from the original owner of it in the state of Alabama. And it's a 65 M16, I believe.
Okay. And two other things here that we want to mention, of course, Hall of Honor and the CD. Mike, you want
to... On those two topics?
Mm-hmm. Since I think probably you were very closely associated with it, those more so.
I don't remember what year. I just accidentally got involved with that thing myself by meeting Johnny Carson, the grandson of Fiddling John Carson, and that was really the first time I was aware of that, and I learned that same year that they were inducting a large number of bluegrass people that particular year into the Bluegrass Hall of Honor, so that was more a different group, I guess, so we started looking around to see who else, you know, should be included in that, and of course Donnie's name came to the top, so mentioned that, and I don't know who did up the bio, but boy, I think one of your daughters did it up for us, as a matter of fact, and submitted it, and of course he was naturally selected to be inducted, and Johnny Carson, Phyllis Cole, did the thing up right. I don't know what you might tell us about. Did y'all play up there at all that year?
The band didn't, but all of us that were being inducted were on the stage
that's
together.
Right.
I believe you were emceeing
that segment, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. So virtually everybody that was inducted that year, we'd been playing music together for many, many years. And first, I was totally surprised, very, very pleased, but totally surprised. And the night of the banquet and the awards, being around all of the people that I'd been kind of grew up in the music mm-hmm. with, I may have been the oldest one inducted now that I look back.
No.
It was just a great night. And I do appreciate my daughters, Lori and Lisa, providing Mike with the information for the introduction. And thank Mike tremendously for mentioning my name. Great an honor. And, you know, I just... I couldn't be more pleased with that.
That whole group kind of opened the door, really, for bluegrass. I mean, it is the Atlanta Country Music Hall of Fame. But thanks to Johnny and Phyllis and that group, I think Johnny came to some realization himself maybe that year as to how much bluegrass there was in the area and how strong the tradition was. So that group kind of opened the door, and there have been numerous inductees every year since then.
Okay, that gets us up to the latest CD. And one of the things that I was really pleased to see was when I opened up BU not too long back, they had a very positive review of your latest CD effort there. So maybe you'd want to comment a little bit on that and tell us maybe a little bit of how it came about, how the project came about, how you selected the material that went in it, and so on.
Well, it had been many, many years since we had recorded that first 78 album, and both Mike Steed and I are getting a little long in the tooth, and we thought, you know, we should take advantage of these young musicians while we have them and try to get another recording done. So it was done at Songhouse Studio in Noonan, Georgia. Cody Deal was the owner, and he was a musician with Alan Jackson when Alan was playing in Noonan. And the sound engineer, Alex McCullough, a talented, talented young man, not only as a musician but as a technician, was the engineer for it. And the musicians on the CD, the current configuration of Bullsboro, and that's Jeff Partridge on banjo, David Steed on mandolin, Zach Steed on guitar, David Steed on mandolin, Mike Steed on guitar, and myself playing bass. And the three younger boys, they can sing all the parts. Mike is a great baritone and perhaps even a better bass player, a bass singer. So we thought we had everything there for the nucleus of another CD. And we just kind of pitched on the table some songs that we thought we would like to do. And again, we didn't want to try to sound like other bands, because we're just not talented enough to sound as good as they do. And so we selected the material, and everybody had a little input into the arrangements. And Wally Alford, playing dobro, we asked him to come sit in on a couple of numbers. Al Smith came in, played guitar on a song or two. And it just kind of all gelled, all came together. There's a little bit of everything from traditional music, with Jeff singing In the Pines, to Zach singing Will You Lay With Me in a Field of Stones. And Mike, who was the author of that?
David Allen Cole.
David Allen Cole. And kind of an odd situation that particular night. Wally came down to play dobro, brought us, just grabbed a case up and came down. Regrettably, when he got there, he had a guitar case and not a dobro case. So Mike had a dobro, and we made arrangements to get it up there. That we didn't have a capo, so we constructed one out of a carpenter's pencil that we found in the recording studio, and a rubber band, and Wally played that dobro like that. Then after the session was over on that sitting on top of the world, there was a Hammond organ in there, I guess, what is it, B3 that everybody talks about? And Wally was in there fooling around while we were trying to kind of mix down what we had done and listen to it. And Zach said, you know, wouldn't it be pretty cool if he could do something with that on that sitting on top of the world? So they went in there and huddled up with Wally, and so he was kind of making something up as he went. And he said, yeah, I believe we can do this. And so I believe we got that in one take.
That's a great that's a great introduction to that particular song. And I, of course, was not familiar with the fact that that's an old blues number, but obviously fits right into that. So let me ask you about something on the listening to that CD. Are you playing electric bass on all of it, or are you playing acoustic on some and electric? Because there's a different sound I've noticed, or was that just in the mix?
In the mix, it's all electric. Alex is a magician with the dials, and he was able to get the sound to where it needed to be for each of the tracks that we did. I'm not playing steel strings, though. I'm playing wound strings, right. Gut strings, and I really, really like the sound of that electric bass with those strings, labella, I believe, black labella strings, as opposed to the metal strings.
Got a good sound to it. Mike, I know that we are missing some things that once we all kind of get away from each other here, we'll, even though I'm running out of a voice here at this point, I know we'll wonder why we didn't ask.
Well, I want to go way back and just, because my interest, one of my many interests is still the early days, I just want to go back and you just kind of glossed over and said you heard Jay Iannone play bluegrass and you really loved that stuff. Well, I'm curious where you heard not only them, but where you could go to hear bluegrass. The first bluegrass festival in the whole entire world, the first multi-day bluegrass event, was 1966. The Marietta Festival started 68, I believe, Bill?
68, 69.
68 or 69, and by 73,
mm-hmm.
y'all were started the Bullsboro Festival. So prior to the Bullsboro Festival, I mean, it was had to be one of the earliest ones. But where were you hearing bluegrass? Two questions. Where were you hearing bluegrass, and who were some of the really hot bands in this part of the country when the festival scene started?
Really hot bands in this area? Well, the one I know the best would be Jay Iannone. They were being from Carrollton at that time. I was living in Bremen. they were our Flat and Scruggs. They were strong. They were cutting it just as good as anybody anywhere. And if there's a better harmony singer than Oney Baxter, I don't know who it would be. Walter Butler and them were making music at that time. Huey Wiley, of course, he was with the Bluegrass Five at that time. But he and Kenneth Hood, there was music at Kenneth Hood's transmission shop up in Austell.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. The other part of your question, I'm sorry.
Where else you could hear? Where'd you hear Jay Iannone first? Where else did you hear bluegrass?
Saw them at a place in Bowden Junction, Georgia. It was called the Wander Auditorium. And they fronted Flat and Scruggs. And then I was fortunate to see Flat and Scruggs, I believe, at the old Bremen Gymnasium earlier than that. So you had to hunt it to find it. You could hear it on the radio back then. You know, it wasn't called bluegrass. It was kind of like country farm time, but
mm-hmm.
Flat and Scruggs were on the radio. Stanley Brothers had a radio program. We didn't get it here, but I do know that they had a program. But usually WLBB in Carrollton would play some form of acoustic music back then. But you had to search it out.
Actually, it's funny you mentioned WLBB. I was living in Carrollton in the from mid-50s through about the early 60s, and the first bluegrass, my earliest recollection of hearing anything bluegrass was Flat and Scruggs. I'm sure it was WLBB doing Cabin on the Hill. And I didn't know who it was, but later I realized I had that song in my mind. I remember hearing it on the radio as a kid. And I remember they came on the radio at lunch every day with a banjo. It was either Under the Double Eagle or something like that. There was a noontime radio program on WLBB, and the theme it kicked off with was banjo tune. I'm pretty sure it was Under the Double Eagle.
Probably Don Reno playing. That was one of the songs that he was, or tunes that he was very, very well known for. But mention just one or two other things. We've been fortunate in the 30 years we've been playing. We played for a couple of governors and were instrumental in getting the month of May recognized as Bluegrass Appreciation Month in Georgia. And Governor Busby was in office at that time, and Mike Steed and I worked on that together. And we invited Dillard Rogers, who we admired for promoting the Cobb County Festival, to the governor's office the day that proclamation was signed. And we were fortunate to get a photo with the governor that day, and I still have that. Did a lot of work for President-elect Jimmy Carter when he was running, and we played, I believe, three shows for him. Played the night that he won, then we played the opening of the Carter Library, and I guess that's about as close to playing for the highest elected person anybody could have. And toured a great deal in the 70s, pretty much in Georgia, Florida, and Alabama, playing bluegrass music. Powers Crossroads, we've been there for 30 years, and they were kind enough to let us tour southeastern states and do the promo for their television and radio programs for promoting the arts and crafts show. Met a lot of wonderful, wonderful people in bluegrass. Mike Fleming and I have been friends now for 30 years and still share a love for the music. So it's just been a great 30 years. I wish I could play 30 more, but that'd be going against the odds, I'm afraid.
Didn't you all do some parades? Did y'all do a big parade somewhere in conjunction with Powers too?
Yeah, let's see. I don't know if we played for a parade for Powers, but we played in Atlanta at the Piedmont Park, and that was kind of like a parade every day at the Piedmont Park Arts Festival. Played the opening to open the Braves season. And wow, I can't remember what year that was. That was in probably mid to late 70s. And I'm sure that my failing memory is keeping me from mentioning a few other things that we really had a great time doing. But it's just been a super, super 30 years.
Well, we still have one or two more questions about some of those things, but at this point in time, what do you see for Ballsboro?
Well, this year we hope that we're going to be able to get in the studio and do a gospel project, all gospel project. That's been a dream of mine for a long time, and well, for both Mike Steed and myself. Mike grew up loving Southern gospel music as much as I did, and we want to do a CD with all Albert Brumley songs, and the title we hope is going to be Ballsboro Sings Brumley. And I think he's written somewhere between 600 and 800 songs, so surely we'll be able to find 15 or so that we'll be able to do. We want to tour a little bit more than what we have in the past. We've got young parents in the band, so they're still, you know, having to be pretty close to home due to family obligations and responsibilities. All of Mike's children, my children, are grown, so we're pretty much footloose and fancy free. So we'd like to tour and do a few of some of the larger festivals as maybe an opening act, and we're not going to headline any of those big time shows, but we'd like to make the rounds and maybe tour a few more festivals and maybe get out another two or three CDs before we can't get up and off the stage.
Well, I guess one thing I would like to hear a little bit more about. I heard a rumor once upon a time that you and Mike Fleming made a journey into West Virginia to search for all kinds of obscure musicians. And I think you probably know what I'm referring to here. So if you'd like to share as much or as little of that as you would feel comfortable with, I would really appreciate that.
That might have been the trip to see Mr. Everett Lilly. Is that it, Mike?
That was the trip, yeah. Covered about three or four states.
Yeah, we did. And again, Mike gets the credit for this. He took the initiative, got on the internet, made contact, interworking with all of his friends, networking, I guess, is the word I was searching for, and found out where Mr. Lilly could be contacted, and took all the initiative to do that. And away we went. Now, was that the trip we went through Kentucky and
yeah, we left here and went to Lexington, where we met with Frank Godbey and Tom Adler at a jam session at Frank Godbey's house.
Yeah.
That first night that we got in, I think that was, we left here, and that was the first night. We stopped somewhere, and, well, we made a lot of stops. The first one was at a music store in White Horse Music or White Horse, Kentucky, I've forgotten. But Randy Hayes, who was a bass player with J.D. Crowe at one time and then also bass player and guitar player with Keith Whitley, we knew he was working at a music store there in the middle of Kentucky, so we stopped by there. And just introduced ourselves and visited with him. Then we went on to Lexington and hooked up with Frank Godby and Tom Adler and had a little jam session. From there, we went on went to Sandy Hook, Kentucky, I guess, next.
But Lee Allen, was that trip or was that another trip?
No, exactly. We went to Lee Allen's next. That's right. Lee Allen, who is now married to Roy Lee Sinner's widow, and also was a songwriter and a performer in his own right. And they took us down to visit Roy Lee Sinner's grave, visited with him, even got a video to prove it. Left from there and went to Sandy Hook to see the Whitley family.
And we found in an old 76 Bluegrass Unlimited magazine where Lee Allen was the emerging songwriter of the year, and his article was just opposite the page promoting the Bullsboro Bluegrass Festival. We visited with him one day, made music, y'all sang some duets together. That was a great time. Finally made our way to West Virginia, and we stopped at the foot of the mountain where Everett had told Mike to just stop and call, and he'd come down and meet us, and I was kind of insisting that Mike just find out where he lived, and we'd drive on up there. I didn't want to inconvenience him, and he said, "You boys just don't go anywhere. You'll never find where I live," and he was right. But he showed up down there in about 30 minutes or so, dressed up in a suit, looked like he was about to go on stage and perform. And we followed him back to his house, spent all that day with him. He was such a gracious host, filled us in. As a matter of fact, I believe he was the first person to organize an overseas tour for bluegrass bands.
First bluegrass act to go to Japan and set up the tours for Monroe and everybody that followed.
Autographed a couple of old Lilly Brothers posters for us, and then invited us to his son's wedding reception. I believe that son and his wife at that time had gotten married a month or 6 weeks before, but they had to be on the road, the band did. And so they were having a reception a little late, and they invited us to it, and so we went over to the local schoolhouse there. Was that Coal Creek?
Clear Creek. Clear Creek, West Virginia.
We're just amazed at the fact that they got on stage and entertained the guests for about maybe a set or so, and then what a thrill it was to meet him. What a thrill. And if he's not in the IBMA Hall of Fame, he ought to be.
They are as of last year.
I think it was last year.
Okay,
last
great.
Year, yeah. He and Brother B.
Yeah.
Of course, the stated purpose of our trip was to see where Don Stober was buried. That was our excuse. And he did take us down the road and point up the hill where there was hardly a road, hardly anything, and allowed us to have, you know, about half a mile up that hill, there was a little cemetery, but we wouldn't be able to get up there today.
So was it raining? Or had it
had
been? Yeah, because it was muddy, and he didn't much want to try to make that climb, nor did I.
Yeah, there wasn't even a road.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Right. One of Mike's hobbies is grave rubbing, and he'll have to explain in detail what that is. But
that's a story for another day.
But we have driven far and wide to rub some gravestones.
We packed a lot into that trip. Spent time with Keith Whitley's mother and brother. We saw Dwight.
Yeah, we did. And Dwight's son.
Yeah, that's right.
Who played, we jammed with him some that night. So it was a great trip. Great trip. I can't wait for Mike to retire so we can not let working for a living interfere with our fun. So hurry up, Mike.
Okay. Well, Donnie, I certainly appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us to help scan the photos and to give us this information. One of the things that usually I like to ask anyone that I'm talking with toward the end, and anything that you would like to add would be great, but is there anything that I haven't asked or that Mike hasn't asked or that you haven't thought about that maybe we should have?
Oh, wow. Bill, I can't think of a thing. I could talk bluegrass music all night, but I guess in closing for myself, I would like to say I appreciate all the work and time and energy that the two of you have put into gathering information on bluegrass music, and I wish y'all continued success with that project and hope it goes to the heights that y'all would like to see it do. And what great friends to have. So that about does it for me.
Mike, is there anything else that that you think of?
Nothing else that I could get Donnie to tell us about that you could print or record. The rest of it's top secret stuff. So.
This might be a good time turning the recorder off.
Okay, thank you, Donnie.
Thank y'all. Wow, thank you very much.